Welcome to What You Know About RJ, Sharing Stories and Skills of Restorative Justice, a podcast of the California Conference for Equality and Justice. I'm your host, Gilbert Salazad, and on today's episode, I want to pause and acknowledge the caretakers of the land in which I am currently standing upon and living on, and that is the folks, the nation of Tongva. This is Tongva land here in what is called Long Beach. And I also particularly want to acknowledge a very sacred village site very near the home that I inhabit, which is Pavunga, which is also located on what is also called the California State University of Long Beach. And so I wanted to name that particularly in to honor the very special VIP guest that I'm very, very excited to be in space with. I will pass the mic to Edward to introduce himself.
Good morning, Gilbert.
Good morning.
I'm very happy to be here. To the listening audience, me and Gilbert were playing email tag on and off, and we finally come to an understanding that this is the date, this is the time, and so I'm happy to be here. And as far as introductions go, I just want to step back and first acknowledge Gilbert for giving that land acknowledgement. And I'll talk more about that as I go on. So I really appreciate that. So for myself, I spared Gilbert the challenge of saying who I am in my language. My white name is Dr. Edward Balandra, but in my homelands, I am called Wambali Wapaha Hokshila. And a lot of times I like to have settlers say my name because that's important. I think when Gilbert talked about acknowledging the homelands, we say the name of the nation and of the people and of a sacred site. So that comports with what we say about, say who I am, say my name, say my peoples. And that gives us the humanity that has been not given to us, even as we talk to this day. And there's several examples out there that we could point to. So I am, and most people just call me Edward, makes it easier on them, but my nation and my people, we call ourselves the Ocheti Shakoi Oyate, which is the people of the seven fires. The settlers have known us over the years as Sioux Indians, but we call ourselves the Ocheti Shakoi Oyate. And the language we speak is Lakota. And that has gotten some currency over the past generation. We identify as Lakota people. And then we have two other dialects that are mutually intelligible, and that's Dakota and Nakota. We, in our homeland, crosses the Canadian US border, which makes for interesting travels between US and Canada. To a point where one time a settler on the Canadian side, a customs agent or border guard, even called me an illegal alien at one time. And so the contradictions always pop up in our daily lives and the things that we do. So that's, and then of course, my land acknowledgement, I always give that too. And I always say that I am in my homelands that is currently occupied illegally by the settlers. And I have to say that because it reminds people that this is an ongoing process. It's not some historic time frame that we're looking at. It's ongoing, certainly from the past to the present and well into the future. So my land acknowledgement when I'm in my homelands is that I'm currently in my homelands that is illegally occupied by the settlers today. So, and I also work for Living Justice Press. I'm the editor of the Colorizing Restorative Justice, and Gilbert was one of our contributors along with 19 others. And so we were happy to have him write for us. And I certainly enjoyed his article. I could probably flip this right now and start interviewing him if I wanted to. All right, well, that's who I am. Thank you.
Edward, thank you for that. I wanted to start with some community building questions. One is, what is a smell and a sound from your home?
Sound and smell. Particularly during the summer, the sound is the wind. Hmm. That's something I grew up on in the Northern Plains. We have lots and lots of wind. In my language, we call them the Kateoyate, the wind nation, the wind people. Mm-hmm. And they are the ones that carry our messages and our voices to all four directions. So that's often a constant sound I hear all the time. And I'm so used to it. Smells, wow, that's a, you know, if I had to say something, it's just probably the food we cook back home. You know, as colonized as it is, we try to indigenize it the best we can. Mm-hmm. But I was just talking to one community member back home, and you know, I'm drinking coffee right now, but I just told her I really miss, we make a certain kind of bread, and I told her I really miss that. And so I think next time I go home, she'll probably have some made for me. You know, that's just how we are. I mean, the people are very generous that way. And so, but a smell of this bread that is not necessarily baking, we pan fry this bread. And so, that's a smell I kind of think about, you know, especially when I'm having coffee.
For me, I grew up in Orange County land, which is not very far from here, from Long Beach. When I think of a smell, well, I think of my grandmother's house. When I think of sound, I think of the columpio, the swing, like in the backyard, and just the sound of the chain hitting the top of the pole, because it was something that whenever we would go visit, we would always, I have a lot of cousins, and we would go and we would swing and we would go down the slide, and we would, you know, there was a whole playset. And so just the sound of the chain on the pole just reminds me of play. And for smell, there was so many different kinds of trees in the backyard. And so, and they actually, as you swung, if you went the other way, you would swing into the fig tree. You know, I being little, I couldn't identify what smell was what. I think if I was older and walked in there, I would be able to. But I think just this smell of things growing, pomegranates and figs and these little sour apples and cactus, and particularly on Saturdays, after Saturday, Sundays around 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, when my grandfather would water. And it would take hours to water the front yard, the backyard, water everything, and do the maintenance that he wanted to do. And just the smell of wet grass in the early evening. A final question for community building is, what's the first thing you did this morning?
Oh my gosh. Well, the first thing I did this morning, of course, especially when I get out of bed, and I always tell people this, the first thing I do is, I step on my homelands, which is stolen land. And I always go through that. I have a short exercise that I go through with settlers. And of course, that was one of the things that I always ask is, what is the first thing you do when you get out of bed? And thanks for segueing that, because one of the things that, you know, this came from a colleague of mine, Kay Holmes, who actually, we were talking and she had raised that, like, what's the first thing you do when you get out of bed in the morning? And of course, a lot of people say, well, I will shower, or I will read, or I will run, pray, whatever. But the truth is, the first thing you do when you get out of bed in the morning is you step on stolen native land. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. And what's important about that is when the settlers think about that, if they ever think about it, in cases like what we're talking now, it is so foreign to them because they never think about it. And that's the point. They never think about that. The theft of land and the genocide of indigenous peoples has been so normalized. That's not what they think about when they, or that's not the first thing they do when they get out of bed in the morning, is they plant their feet on, you know, stolen native land. So, and there's several exercises that bring consciousness, you know, to settler colonialism in North America. So, thank you.
I would like to invite the listeners to, and I do this in training, particularly in this very emotionally fatigued moment that folks are in, that we are all in now, but I would like to invite listeners to imagine something in nature that has depth to it, as we move, to invite listeners to move into that depth. And so for me, it's I love water, but, and I love being in water, but when there's a moment in the ocean where if I can't feel my feet on the bottom, there's a slight freak out for me. And so I'm gonna bring in that image of depth for me. So I wanna bring in an image of depth for listeners as we move into this conversation. And I wanna say that particularly because, Edward, when I heard you, there was another podcast where I heard you name this question, you named it and then you responded to it. And it was just, for me, it was such a striking question and response, because I was also thinking, oh, I take a breath or I do yoga or I pray. And then, but your response was a reminder of, no, that's not the first thing that I do in the morning. So with that, with the image of depth that hopefully folks have in their minds as we move into this conversation, Edward, can I ask you, who is a settler? What is a settler colonialism?
You know, the metaphor you use about being in water and then that part where your feet are not touching the bottom. Mm-hmm. This is the point where people's feet are like not touching the bottom now. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of unsettling going on, right? Mm. And so basically a settler is, you know, in the most simplistic way is a non-indigenous person. And that covers a whole lot of people, but that would be the most basic and simple definition. Is a settler is someone who is non-indigenous to the North American continent. And of course, a lot of literature has come out since then about, because that's so simplistic. And of course we know that things like settler colonialism, anti-racism, anti-Black, and all this is so nuanced and complicated, you know, but for a very specific definition, almost like the binary, you're not indigenous, you are a settler. Mm. And of course that raises a whole host of issues, right? One is, I don't think people know or identify as settlers. And that's one of the interesting things about settler colonialism, is that the structure of it normalizes the fact that you self-indigenize. And what do I mean by self-indigenizing? You know, part of it comes, well, a lot of it comes out of the Western tradition. European named John Locke, who said, when you work the land with your own labor and sweat, basically, you somehow attain a level of ownership over that land. And over the years, it has become private property. So a lot of what I call self-indigenizing among settlers is that, and you see this in the narratives of the settling of the North American continent, And it's a settler narrative, like, we work this land, we put our labor into this land, and we plowed and we built, and we, so this settler narrative is a self-indigenizing narrative that says, we put our labor into this land, therefore we own it, which is totally false, because there were indigenous peoples here thousands of years before the Europeans even set foot on this part of the world. And so settler becomes a term in which, on one hand, the way the West looks at it, it's the taming of the West, it's the taming of nature, and it has a lot of positivity to it in that sense, the settling of the US or the settling of Canada. But when you actually look at the other side of the ledger, what does that settling really mean? It means the theft of indigenous lands. It means the genocide of indigenous peoples. So settler colonialism then becomes this unique form of colonization in which non-indigenous people literally come displace indigenous peoples and create their own national community. And settler colonialism has this, what they call logic of elimination. And what that means is that native permanence necessarily has to be eradicated or diminished to the point where it's meaningless. And so that's what we're dealing with settler colonialism. And I do make the point that, and the literature says this too, Patrick Wolf, I think, had coined a phrase that settler colonialism is a structure and not an event. So there's the past of settler colonialism, which is the coming of the Europeans, European descended peoples. There's the present, which is the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, these kind of settler states, if you will, and the future, which the structure is then, it's always ongoing. It doesn't necessarily stop. So when we talk about settler identity or who is a settler, that becomes, I think, with all the nuances that we talk about in this podcast. And so it is contested in a lot of ways, because once indigenous people call out settlers for their narrative of self-indigenization, it begins to really complicate the picture in ways that I think people have not really thought about, because the structure has normalized the genocide of indigenous peoples. Like, oh, well, that's too bad that happened. But there are indigenous peoples alive today. The very people that you have mentioned exist to this day. We are still here. We are still in our homelands. And so I think that's part of the unsettling. That's where people's feet are not touching the bottom now. They're wiggling their toes, or they're trying to find that structure that supposedly gives them their sense of settler entitlement, if you will. Mm. And so that's the unsettling of the settler, is then we begin to interrogate just what does that mean? What does that encompass? And I think that discussion is just wide open. Up in Canada, I think the Canadians are a little bit more, they kind of wrap their arms around that a little bit more than the Americans have. So I think that's really interesting. And maybe to go to the point of when we talk about settler colonialism and identity, you know, you started out the podcast with the land acknowledgement. When I talk to Canadian audiences, like Zoom or just when I'm up there, almost without exception, a settler will get up and acknowledge that these are the traditional homelands of whatever indigenous peoples that are there. Mm-hmm. I have found in the States, and you're one of the few exceptions, when we get into this, there's no land acknowledgement by the Americans at all. And if it is, it's just kind of an afterthought. So I really appreciate the fact that you started out the podcast with that, because that's part of settler colonialism and the logic of elimination. Mm-hmm. That we're totally eviscerated from that narrative. And so I find that very striking between a settler state like Canada and a settler state like the US, where up there the settlers acknowledge the indigenous peoples, the land acknowledgement is there. And then down in the States, it's practically non-existent, which tells us how powerful and shows and indicates how powerful settler colonialism is in the lives of people, of non-indigenous people. So they never have to think about it.
You know? I had been doing the work of restorative justice in schools for, it's been like over 7 years now. And I confess that this, at the start of this year, I was feeling just sort of like, okay, well, I think I've done all that I can and I've received all that I can. And then taking it back to the Colorizing Restorative Justice book, and then I went to your chapter at the end of the book and became unsettled and didn't feel the ground underneath me, and instantly knew, well, this is the next phase of my unsettling or my unveiling what I have to think about and act upon within this work. I've been super grateful for that this year, in addition to having to virtualize and facilitate virtually, yes, but in terms of how this work has to expand in myself. And so with that, I want to take us to a question that is super important to ask and super important for all of us to hear of, what is the first harm?
When I began this journey, you know, I've been around the margins of restorative justice and restorative practices for at least 17 years. I never was in it as long as, let's say, people like yourself have been. But the few times that I have been in, participated in restorative justice or restorative practice circles, there were some things that just stuck out to me. And one is, you know, one of the tenets of restorative justice and restorative practices to address the harms as a result of wrongdoing. And so as an Indigenous person, on occasion when I would sit in a circle and I would hear, you know, some of the harms that were being addressed in a circle, and because of a wrongdoing, it occurred to me that there's a greater harm that's happened here. You know, and as an Indigenous person sitting in circle, we're looking at one or two others in that Indigenous people in that circle, and we're looking at each other like we're not even talking about. That's where the first harm began to emerge. Like, they're not even talking about the theft of land. They're not even talking about the genocide, the first harm. And so the question that I raised is, if restorative justice and restorative practice is to achieve a level in which there is something restorative or reparative, the movement, the field, the practitioners, the theorists, they need to address that first harm. And we're not even talking about slavery yet. Mm-hmm. But that first harm of theft of land, and stealing is a crime. I've said that. Stealing is a crime, and it's still a crime today. So that was the first harm. I just wanted to bring that out, that the settlers and RJ, they really need to take a deep reflective look at the harm, you know, what harms they are addressing as a result of wrongdoing. And one of them is the first harm, the theft and genocide of Indigenous peoples. And until they come to some kind of understanding of that, I had proposed to the the RJ field and the RP, the restorative practice field of the discipline or the movement, until that first time is truly addressed in a very substantive way, it's hard for Indigenous people to sit in a circle and talk about these other harms that have happened, because there are settlers in RJ. And if they're not willing to address that, then what's going on here? So that was the first harm. And I think that was a pretty high bar that I had set out in my chapter. Like, you need to really go back to the first harm to begin to address all these other harms that were subsequent to it, be it slavery, be it, you know, marginalization of women, other communities of color. It just keeps going. And so that was, and there's controversy around that, because, and a lot of the contributors talked about white fragility in the book. They referenced white fragility as a result of my talking to people about settler colonialism. I've been using the term settler fragility. But there's a defensive posture that settlers take when you begin to talk about the first harm and the defensiveness that arises out of that. And it's pretty interesting to see those kind of reactions. And they vary all over the board. So I know that, and I've come to this conclusion that an Indigenous person such as myself can walk into a room and our very presence unsettles settlers, because we convey that we are still here and there's still a harm that hasn't been addressed. And that needs to happen. And the literature shows that one of the things about settler colonialism was to basically eliminate Indigenous peoples, to put a settler society in place at the extermination of Indigenous peoples. Well, if Indigenous peoples are still around and we're still talking about theft of land and genocide, our narrative doesn't square with what the settlers have been told since the beginning of their coming over here. Like, at some point, Indigenous peoples will have long vanished. We would be exterminated, or we would have been assimilated to the degree that we're no longer recognizable. And that was the understanding of settler colonialism. Well, the reality is we're still here and we're still wanting justice.
If non-Native or non-First Nations folks in Canada have done more, what kind of work do you think they've done around their own settler fragility or around guilt and shame versus settler folks here in the U.S.?
Well, that's a really good question, because there's a variety of responses that settlers can take. For one, I know up in Canada, I'm very close to a First Nation up there. They call themselves the Wet'suwet'en people. And they, over the past probably 10 years, almost 10 years, almost two decades, let's see, almost 10 years for sure, they have organized against pipelines being put in their traditional territories. And throughout those years, particularly during the summer months, they've invited settlers to their, what they call the, back then was called the action camp, where they built infrastructure. They built a healing center. And so you had these settlers come and help with the sovereignty of the Wet'suwet'en people. And it's a complicated situation up there, but I've met many settlers from Canada who had come to help the Wet'suwet'en people. And they themselves participated and partook in building up this infrastructure in their homelands to stop the pipeline. And so when the RCMPs, you know, that's the National Police Force of Canada, came in to arrest the traditional leadership, the hereditary chiefs, the settlers throughout Canada went and shut down Canada, as well as Indigenous people. So they were accomplices, not just allies, but accomplices in the shutdown of Canada. Mm-hmm. And it has really changed the dynamics of settler-native relations in Canada, because, you know, money pours in because they need a legal defense. Money comes in for materials to keep building the infrastructure, like the wellness center and other facilities to help resettle, for the Indigenous people, the Wasotan people, to live in their traditional homelands. And so I have been very moved by what settlers have done up there. They put their bodies out, physically put their bodies out there. And when the traditional leaders of the Wasotan people put a call out for help, I mean, it was incredible what the settlers did, you know, and in all likelihood, it was one in which they fully understood and were very conscious of their positionality as settlers. Mm-hmm. And they were willing to risk that, to do the right thing, to begin to undo a harm. And so that has been a very insightful lesson to watch how the settlers in Canada are owning that settler identity, because a lot of good literature about settler colonialism is coming out of Canada, written by settlers and articulating what that settler identity means, not only to them, but to a settler nation, and how that has impacted Indigenous peoples in Canada. So I know it's possible, you know, and so, you know, Indigenous peoples, you know, we have married settlers, we had children by settlers, we have settler friends, we drink with settlers, we party with settlers. So it's a very complex dynamic that goes on. But ultimately, what we want from settlers is justice and to acknowledge that we have a right to exist, to coexist as a peoples. So those are the bigger frameworks. So when we ask for, when we push for permanence, that goes against the grain of settler colonialism, which is all about the extermination of Indigenous people. It's called the logic of elimination. You just displace people, Indigenous people, you move them to one place. Settlers then start their own society, start their own nation, like the US. It's very much a settler state, mm-hmm. at the expense of Indigenous peoples. So it's probably a very good time to really rethink and talk about these issues that you're raising. I mean, I have to give your podcast a lot of accolades and kudos for talking about this issue.
Well, bringing in a First Nations voice of Anna Sol in what's a resource for Indigenous solidarity, which was posted in a newsletter recently by the Water Protector League Collective, that includes a list of practices and actions and mind frames for non-Native and Indigenous folks. And that list, her article includes suggestions to locate yourself, to ask yourself, who are the Indigenous peoples that the land belongs to, who has been responsible and in care of the lands that you were born on, that you live on, that you work on, that you vacation and play on, what's their history? And then she also calls in to socially locate yourself. So she says, we must socially locate ourselves in relationship and responsibility to our own ancestry and the impact on the lives of one another. She calls in addressing guilt and shame, seek connection, not isolation. And what for me was really striking was she, in writing about appropriation, they write, instead, turn that same energy or desire for meaning, depth, art, beauty, connection, culture, power, land, spirit, or ancestors towards learning about your own ancestry. Can you, Edward, if there's any thoughts or what strikes you in that list from her or from them?
I think what I read from this list, which is a good list, she's really asking settlers, for example, to have some humility about themselves, to begin to inquire deeply into, you know, quite frankly, it's like meeting someone and saying, "What's your story?" Not like, "What do you do for work?" Mm-hmm. Your job title, you know, how many friends you have on Facebook. It's like, "What's your story?" And when he asked that, and I asked that question a lot of times when I would go visit my relatives up in British Columbia. All these settlers that were at this Wet'suwet'en action camp, and I'd sit down with them, you know, and I'd say, "So what's your story?" And that had such a profound effect. Like, you're not asking me what I do. You're not asking me where I'm from. You're asking me what my story is. And that just opened up a whole range of interaction, because then you can start going deeper and deeper and deeper. And as someone who's wants to decolonize, as you hear their story, you begin to ask these questions. Like, well, you know, they'll tell you where they were born. And they'd say, "Well, what indigenous people were there?" "Well, I don't know." "Why don't you know?" You know, and those are very non-threatening kind of ways. You know, you're sitting around having coffee, or people like to smoke a lot. And so it's just a very natural way of just dwelling deeper. So I think what these questions are really pointing to is a sense of settler humility. Like, you know what? Positionally, we may be have all the power because of the structures that we put in place to ensure our futurity, but I'm engaged, you know, to engage an indigenous person and talk about the harm that has been done. And I think that's one of the things that has happened up in, particularly in Canada, particularly out in British Columbia, is as the Wet'suwet'en people begin to tell their story, which is critical for restorative justice and restorative practices, you know, and there wasn't any formal process like sitting in a big circle. People just sat around and visit. It was just a very informal process, very natural. The segue was very natural. So those stories, they began to exchange stories in ways that was very natural. And what I really particularly liked about that was when settlers came, there was a checkpoint to enter into the Wet'suwet'en territory. You had to agree to a lot of things. Mm. They were just very practical and common sense things. Like, you will listen to the leadership of this indigenous lands. We are the owners of this land. So, and I think that unsettled some of the settlers. Like, "Oh, we have got to behave ourselves." We have got to conduct ourselves in a very relational way. And so what they did was they took the lead of the indigenous peoples. And that's where you find some, that's very rare in settler states. Settlers often will not listen to indigenous peoples, even on their own land, and just act as if there's someone who has no relatives at all. And that relational aspect is critical. So I think the questions that are here has a lot to do with just humility. Mm-hmm. Just taking self-reflection of who you are and your history. And then what's that mean, you know, with respect to indigenous peoples then? And I think that's part of the consciousness raising among settlers. Like, there's so much privilege that settlers have that they don't even, that they're so unaware of. And it really contrasts with indigenous peoples, where we don't have the kind of daily activities. I mean, we, you know, even people of color and indigenous people, every day we're reminded of our position all the time. And, you know, and that plays out in so many ways. I'll just share a story real quick with, I'm in my homelands. I'm right now, I'm in St. Paul, and there's a river bike trail. So I walk that every day. And for what they call Columbus Day, right? That's a settler structure thing, mm-hmm. Columbus Day. You know, the settlers try to get around that and call it Native American Day or Indigenous Day. But so I was walking along the bike path and I seen all these placards that were on wire and they were stuck in the ground. And it said, in my language, this is, you know, this is Lakota land. This place is called St. Paul. It was called Imenizashka. And so I was reading all that and I'm going like, oh, this is kind of cool. But the difference is these were just placards on wire. So when the wind blew, they were blown down. People could move them. People could get them. Right next to these placards was this obelisk looking monument that it would take a crane to move that thing. So permanence. So as an indigenous person, I'm walking around thinking, oh, that's kind of nice that they're acknowledging this is my homelands, but it's on a piece of flimsy cardboard that can be moved. Yet there's these monuments and these historical these historical plaques. You couldn't move those unless you had a football team behind you. So I was looking at that saying, so what this is saying is this is for our impermanence here. The signs that they put up, a good thing, but they can be taken down and they are gone now. But these other solid monuments to settlers will always be here. Mm-hmm. So that's how we are confronted with settler colonialism every day about our impermanence, you know? And so that becomes that's only one manifestation, but there's several others, of course, that we could talk about.
The list that I just read from Seoul, they describe themselves, it's a French word, a Métisse person, a person of indigenous and European heritage and lineage. And, you know, all of these questions are, and the next question in particular is threaded in my own journey of myself in this moment. I had spent my childhood, my adolescence, my teen years, my early adulthood, feeling and acknowledging very much my Chicanidad or my Chicano identity. And it had been around that time that my family, my mother found out that her father, who she didn't know as much or as directly, but my family found out that my great-grandfather, Miguel Salcido, was a citizen of the Tahanuatam Nation. When my mother found that out and found out that there was the possibility of registering within the nation, it was not something that I wanted to do because I know nothing about them. I know nothing about that culture. So how would I claim something that I don't know? And then I made the choice to register, but I had made I knew that I had a desire to learn. And so it, particularly in this current year, I've been actually very much connected to the time that I've been doing restorative justice work. And so as I moved into more depth of circle keeping and restorative justice, I also was called in to move into more depth of understanding my great-grandfather and the nation and the desert and that land. And each time that I go, each time that I see a sahuaro cactus, which is a person, and there's the belief, the acknowledgement that a sahuaro is an ancestor, is a person, is a grandfather. And so each time that I'm in the desert, there's a feeling of connectedness. And so So as I continue to move into depth of my own understanding, my own curiosity, my own responsibility and relationship to, there's a question that I want to ask that I hold in my own journey itself of what is the responsibility of a settler of color?
That question is really being asked because, you know, as for settlers, you know, if you're non-Indigenous, then we have to deal with settlers of color, and for them, that's a very complicated discussion to have, because one of the things, especially in the U.S., maybe even Canada for sure, but particularly in the U.S., you know, the invitation for immigrants to come and then contribute, you know, pull yourselves up by the bootstraps, work hard. That's the self-indigenizing settler narrative. And so when the people of color come voluntarily to this country, they become settlers as well. But the interesting thing about that settler is like with, they've experienced the racism too. They've experienced the oppression that has come with that. With the exception of the indigenous Africans and their descendants, most every other immigrant came voluntarily. And while many of them would say, well, I left the place because of the oppression that was being experienced in some other, in their homeland or their country, and they came here. But the idea is that, you know, you work hard, you save, you struggle, you pull yourselves up by your own bootstrap. That's part of the initial white settler narrative that people of color will buy into. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a very complicated discussion for indigenous people and people of color. And what makes it even more so is that, you know, it's almost as if the people of color are honorary settlers, because they, although they have that settler narrative working, that they're working on, trying to make their lives better, their family life better. The original settlers, the white settlers, they're the ones that have perpetrated racism and marginalized those settlers of color. So now we get into a really interesting dynamic of then how do we understand settlers of color? They can be accomplices for indigenous peoples, and we've all experienced oppression. But the one thing that separates us from settlers of color is that we have lost the land. And they are the beneficiaries of that land loss as well as white settlers. So how do we begin to negotiate that? And what I find is, I find, let's say, settlers of color to be more open to these kind of discussions, to really dig deep into them, because they've experienced, you know, white settlers' racism. So they understand that. And yet they're also part of that narrative too. So there's this deep struggle and understanding to I think to have discussions with people of color is so valuable for indigenous peoples, to reach out and talk to people of color, because we've all experienced racism all the time and being marginalized in every way possible. And yet I think because of that, that's our common link. So I would say that maybe the settlers of color, you know, just some literature coming out, you know, there are settlers of color who are beginning to write about settler colonialism too. Mm. They say, boy, it feels really different to be in this position. Mm. As a person of color, yet I'm part of the settler narrative. And yet in that settler narrative, I've also been excluded. So there's some So there's some tension within these discussions, but for sure the settlers of color have benefited as well as the white settlers have, because they still are on stolen native land. But I think that awareness is really helpful, because then we can have these discussions. You know, I look for settlers who are willing to be accomplices and help with justice in general. Like, what is it to be just? And work toward undoing the harm. And I think that's probably what, and there's a lot of good literature out there about what is settler colonialism and people of color as settlers. It opens up a discussion, and one which I'm very hopeful for. I think it's just really a good time to have these discussions, to be honest with you. But the settler of color issue, that is where a lot of the action is going to be, I think, between indigenous peoples and people of color. I really believe that it's going to be very fruitful. It may not always be the easiest discussion to have, but I think there's some natural affinities that can happen there a lot. So I'm hopeful about that. Mm-hmm. And I think when people of color realize that they are also settlers, they have to kind of negotiate that internally too. You know, and then what does that mean? And I think that's kind of self-reflection is really good, to be honest with you. So thank you for raising that question, man. Dave,
that's up. Yeah, I mean, I think as I, you know, I thought I knew my story as a Chicano person. And then in the process of unsettling myself of that, my story is in a different, is also in another, a larger container. And so when I put my story into a different container, or I look more at what's around me, and I recognize that the container around me is actually different from what I thought it was, then I have to, I think that's where I continue to feel unsettled and to lean in, which is what I do as a circle keeper. If I'm going to create a container for people to feel vulnerable and to take a risk to tell and share their story, then there's a lot of work I have to do within the container, and also a lot of acknowledgement within my own story. And so I appreciate this, what is now swimming in this water. As I'm swimming around, and there's a floating dock, and I'm trying to get to it, but the dock is asking me what's the role of restorative justice in unsettling. Or also, I geeked out, Edward, in your chapter, because you mentioned a line in my chapter, because I write about white fragility. And there's a line that you have in your chapter where you directly name and question the article, which I was super excited and geeked out to see. But you asked, what container can we create to hold dialogue for undoing the first harm? So throwing that to you of what's the role, or what can RJ do to unsettle? What can RJ do? Can't RJ do anything to unsettle the harm?
Well, that notion of container really struck with me as a metaphor. And so if we're going to begin to undo the first harm, we have got to have a container that is up to the task of addressing that first harm. And so what does that really mean? Well, I think it would tell me that relationships are critical. I've read, you know, a lot of the RJ literature and RP literature when it initially started, and certainly circles seem to be very transactional in a lot of ways. You know, you do this, you do this, you do this, you do this. And then, but I would want that container, if it be a circle, to be strong enough to begin to address the first harm. And what does that really mean? I think that means a lot of self-reflection as a settler. What does it mean to be a settler? What that settler identity means, own it. And then ways in which we can begin to address the first harm. And I think in my chapter, I gave a suggestion as how to begin that process. And one of the things has to do with an object they use in circle. And from what I've read in the literature that I've looked at and people I've talked to, there's an object that they use. And I thought, well, why not take that object and make it so that it forces people to acknowledge the indigenous peoples. Like, this is the land that we belong on. This land belongs to. And just as a reminder that first harm, as it goes, if it goes unaddressed, it really demeans and devalues the restorative justice and restorative practice movement. In spite of whatever successes it may have, if it never addresses the first harm, it does really demean the core principle of restorative justice and restorative practice. And so I think the container's gonna have to be strong enough to talk, to have the kind of discussion we're having right now. And what does that really mean? Part of it is the education. I love the questions that you taken, the unsettled questions. From Anna Soul's, I think, article. But that kind of thing is really important to begin to think about and then engage indigenous peoples. I think, you know, we just have to listen to those stories, and no matter how uncomfortable they will be, because there's a lot of hurt and harm in these stories, you know, as a result of that first harm. Not only is it the theft of our homelands and genocide, but, you know, your story about having Tohono O'odham is not that different than people from my own nation who went to the boarding schools. I mean, that was downright criminal what they did to these children, you know. My grandparents went through these boarding schools. My parents had that boarding school experience. And it really messed a lot of people up. And then you have, you know, this Western education model. And then we have adoptions outside. I mean, a lot of Native children were adopted outside their community. And a lot of them are trying to find who they are. And they return. And of course we welcome them, because it was not their fault they were adopted out. It was some white social worker who said, you know, I don't like the way you guys are living because we're poor. We don't have all the amenities. We have kerosene lamps, maybe wood stoves, outhouses. And a white social worker say, this is not fit for a Native child, and then be adopted to a white family. That's genocide. Clear. Just you can't get around that. But then these children find out that they do have a Lakota ancestor. They come back and we just welcome them. So those are the kind of stories that we try to, I think, say this is the harm that goes unaddressed. And the perpetrators are still out there. And it's that structure that's in place. So I think it's really, I think this is going to be a long-term discussion, way past my lifetime, I'm sure. But it's a good, healthy discussion to have. Because at bottom, the way to unsettle a settler and to decolonize is to recognize that we have a right to coexist as indigenous peoples in our own homelands. Yeah, that's all it is, plain and simple.
Yeah. This has been such a pleasure, Edward. Thank you for your time with me today.
Oh my gosh, it's been so wonderful. As you know, the CRJ, we're like a family. I mean, you know, those that can attend our gatherings do, and you know, we've tried to carry on the spirit of relationship with the CRJ contributors, and so we want to do everything we can to support the contributors in the best way we can. And so, and one of the things I really like about this experience is have been meeting people like Gilbert and others and just having the chance to visit.
Only gratitude to you, Edward, to all your ancestors, to all of the responsibilities you have in front of you, to all that you contribute to the book in my day and all my days. And you've been listening to What You Know About RJ, Sharing Stories and Skills About Restorative Justice, a podcast of the California Conference for Equality and Justice. If you would like to know more about our trainings or any of our materials, please go to cacej.org. And if you would like to purchase a copy of Colorizing Restorative Justice, please go to livingjusticepress.org. Please like and subscribe. Please listen to us again. Thank you very much.